Welcome to 21. I'm Drew Lasker. I'm a family man, professional athlete, and business owner of Train Harder 21 and 21 Media. Yvonne Harris and I have teamed up and created this podcast to explore the life lessons that come along with being an athlete. Why 21? It's my jersey number and a key part to my great fortune and career. So it seems fitting for this podcast.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Harris. I'm a proud boy mom and an advocate for efforts that improve the lives of women and children. Experiencing success as an athlete or in any facet of life does not happen by accident. There must be clarity, intention, and the willingness to pivot. Our guests on 21 share their journeys in ways that cause you to reflect, assess, and then take action. We are so thankful for the stories shared on this podcast because Drew and I know their wisdom shortens someone else's path to success. Enjoy this episode of 21.
Welcome to another episode of 21, where we continue to level up for 2021. Today, get ready to get lit as we welcome in our guest who will provide spoken literature called Lit House. He's the author of a novel, Red Now and Laters. Writer and producer, the man of many talents, a warm welcome to the show, Marcus J. Guillory. Marcus, welcome to 21.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dive into your story, Marcus, we're going to go with a little warm-up we call 21 Questions with 21. So without further ado, we're just going to jump right into it. You ready, my man?
Sure.
First question, Whataburger or In-N-Out?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like that.
Yo, Whataburger.
Nike or Adidas?
Nike. Beer or tequila?
Beer.
Beach or mountains?
Beach.
Tupac or Biggie?
Tupac.
Jordan or LeBron?
Jordan.
Texans or Cowboys?
Man.
That's fair.
Popeyes or Chick-fil-A?
Popeyes.
Las Vegas or Miami?
Honestly, neither, but if I had to pick, it'd be Miami.
IHOP or Waffle House?
IHOP.
East Coast or West Coast?
West Coast, all day.
Early bird, night owl?
Nowadays, early bird.
Grilled or fried?
Like for some quick frying shit, man, that ain't cool.
Car or truck?
Oh, what kind of car? And what kind?
Yeah.
I have both. A car.
Bluebell or Häagen-Dazs?
Bluebell.
Coke or Pepsi?
Coke.
Summer or winter?
Summer.
Xbox or PlayStation?
PlayStation.
Dishes or laundry?
Dishes.
City or country?
City.
And finally, club or house party?
House party.
Marcus, you are now off the hot seat.
Okay. Some of that stuff I don't mess with either. You know what I mean? Like, your life, you kind of go through things and you end up certain things and you're not.
Exactly.
Certain kind of places and you're not. Just depends on where your head's at.
When you come to Houston, do you eat at Frenchie's?
No.
No? Just curious.
Questions, do I go to Timmy Chan's? And I cut that out 10 years, 15 years ago.
Oh, wow.
20 years ago for me.
That, and, you know, that was like the second cafeteria at Jones High School. But I can't eat that now. And Frenchie's is kind of different. I like their rice, you know, but I try not to do too much fried food. So what I'll do is when I go to Houston, I like Papa Do's, Frenchie's, used to be Timmy Chan's, used to be in this. But either way, those two places only get one visit from me. That's it.
And, Papa, you know, Do's only gets one visit.
Papa Do's only gets one visit. Well, now it's super salty when I'm really aware of it. like, damn, is this salty, you know? And your palate changes. And more importantly, I cook. So I can cook everything over there. And I cook a lot of Creole food in my house in L.A. So it's not, oh, I got to go. I can finally get that toufee. No, I just had that last week.
Right. And it's super expensive as well. So, you know, you save a lot of bucks just doing it yourself. So while we're on that subject, obviously you're calling in from Los Angeles and that's where you reside now, but you actually grew up in Houston. And so, you know, I come from the West Side out in Katy, but talk to us a little bit about your experience growing up in Houston and then just talk a little bit about your ties to Louisiana.
Houston. I'm from a neighborhood called South Park, which is in the southeast side of Houston. And my schooling, I went to St. James Elementary in Third Ward. And then from there, and I was a parochial school, and I went to, I was in the Vanguard Magnet Program in HISD, which was a gifted magnet program that had me at T.H. Rogers for middle school, which was in Tanglewood near River Oaks, Galleria area. Then, interestingly enough, Jesse H. Jones High School's Vanguard program, which was actually in South Park. I mentioned that trek because that trek would end up being my social ecosystem as a young person in Houston, and your friends and the parties you go to and the dances and stuff like that are kind of based on the people. And for young people, a lot of times it's who you go to school with. So I'm coming from a community that has its and still has its challenges, kind of talking about South Park, that, you know, is kind of mired in the poverty of low expectations. Then I go on to school and I start meeting these Jack and Jill kids. I don't know what the hell that was. And you start socializing with different little orbits of Black folks who so different socioeconomic backgrounds, et cetera. I think what that did for me was inform me of, one, different kind of folks around you and what different possibilities were available based on certain things. And at the same time, my family's from Louisiana. And so I spent a good bit of time going to Southwest Louisiana and visiting cousins and just completely merged in Louisiana Creole culture. And there's a lot of folks from Louisiana and from that culture in Houston. So it thrives and kind of maintains itself. So it's not like you lose one for the other. And so, you know, Houston is what we would consider the urban South, which has different suggestions. You know, you will see somebody riding a horse down the median of a major street, which you don't normally see that. Some of that has to do with the absence of zoning laws in the city of Houston. So you kind of grow up in an area where there's like, you know, there's a store and then next to it is a horse pen. And that's completely normal in Houston. So it's a different kind of urban experience. And later on, I would live in the East Coast and other parts of the country. And you see the differences in terms of, you know, what you're going to see, you know, in a neighborhood. But school gave me an opportunity to meet people and see different parts of the city I wouldn't normally see and kind of expanded my horizons.
What towns in Louisiana, Marcus, is your family from?
My father was born in Bazille and grew up in Lafayette. And my mother was born in Carencro and grew up in Opelousas. And so we're pretty much right there in the middle of the country. Two very old families.
Yeah, beautiful towns. So you mentioned, I guess, your sphere in terms of the schools you went to in Houston, the magnet programs. And I know you've always been so attached to the arts and you've always excelled academically. What sparked your interest in all of that? And like, what did you study in high school to really focus in on your craft?
Nothing specific to what I'm doing right now, which is interesting. Like, nothing about writing anything. My older sister went to PVA, High School for Performing and Visual Arts, and she's a theater major. So, you know, the person babysitting me is dragging me to auditions and rehearsals, and there's theater nerds all around at the house. And fun and vibrant. There's music playing all the time. And so it was very lively and at the same time, very informative because my sister was teaching me a lot of stuff and exposing me to poetry and stuff. You know, fun fact, I mean, I remember going to the very first Kwanzaa celebration in Houston at Shape Center. And not only that, very young, and not only that, the last remnants of the People's Party, which was the remnants of the Black Panther Party in Houston, were there. I remember. That was a long time ago. I was a little bitty dude.
Yeah, and how old were you?
Had to be 5 or 6, something like that. Thomas Melanson had a play called From Africa to Fifth Ward. Deloitte Parker was a young guy then, you know, play smell like Lysol, had that summertime rec center smell. That's, yeah, this, you know, and so and that was because of my sister, you know, and so Inezaki Shange would be around, you know, on the trail ride scene. They were, you know, you grew up seeing her around that scene. At the same time, you'd see Mickey Leland there at the rodeos and stuff and the trail rides. And so that I always found interesting. Later on, when I really realized who these people were, who were out of their element in some respect, but at the same time, completely in it. And Inezaki ended up writing a book of poetry about those days with the Houston Cowboys. And so just kind of interesting. I think you gravitate towards the things that you like. You know, I was listening to music a lot and a lot of jazz, a lot of funk, as well as rap and things like that, and learning a few instruments and stuff. And I played in band in school and, you know, you gravitate, you know, towards the things you're into.
Well, you mentioned some aspects that are very unique to our growing up here in Houston. You touched on the rodeo. You mentioned the trail rides, and your dad was a renowned cowboy. So talk to our listeners about the Black rodeo experience here in Houston, because many people outside of Houston don't even understand the concept.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'll give you some full context. In the 50s, in the late 50s, 6 Black men who liked to ride, knew each other, started the very first Black Trail Ride Association in the country, Prairie View Trail Ride Association. And there was Dr. Poindexter, who was a veterinarian professor at PV. And there was a young guy who had just moved back to the South from LA, actually, who people knew, who was working at the Ship Channel. He was about 24, and that was my dad. So they founded the first one. He was always into horses all since he was little. And 2 of his best friends were the first 2 Black men inducted into the National Bull Ride Hall of Fame, the big one, not the Black one, the big one, Mertis Dykman and Clint Welch. So, you know, we grew up going to trail rides, going feed the horses, you know, this whole kind of culture that comes with it. There's the rodeo competitions would start in the summer. And then there's the trail rides would happen afterwards, particularly in the wintertime. And there's pretty much a bunch of people get together and would say, we're going to ride our horses and our wagons from here to there, right? And with the Houston Fair Stock Show and rodeo, a variety of trail ride associations, not just Black ones, but all kind of folks, move from different parts of the city and converge onto the city for a big parade. And I think I'd been riding at their parade since I was like 3 or 4, you know, either in a wagon riding with my dad. Then I think about 8, I had my own horse, you know. So, yeah, I didn't go heavy into it. I didn't compete. He wanted me to. Just didn't. He trained a lot of young cowboys how to do certain events, calf roping and head and tails with steer roping. So, yeah, a lot of people know him on the scene or knew him.
Yeah. And just listening to your story, you know, it sounds like the South was ingrained in you. You know, that was your way of life. That was your upbringing. But fast forward, you actually moved to Pennsylvania for college.
Yeah.
To attend the University of Penn. So just talk to us a little bit about what went into that decision to move away so far. And then also you attained a BA in philosophy, and just talk about the inspiration in that.
My thought process was simple. All of my friends were going to HBCUs, and that was a big conversation. Now, keep in mind, I was fortunate enough to be of the age when School Days and Cosby Show, A Different World were on TV, supporting and popularizing the idea of African-American young people in college. And that was the hip thing to do. And it looked hip. It looked cool. Everybody's cute.
Yes.
Like, yo, it wasn't about the circle I was in. And we weren't talking about, are you going to graduate from high school? We weren't even talking about, are you going to go to college? Our conversation was, which college are you going to? That was the conversation. And so most of my friends, like I said, I had all these Jack and Jill friends once I went to this, to St. James. And so they were legacy to this HBCU and that HBCU and fraternities and sororities and all of the stuff that I didn't know about, right? What I was able to perceive early was that, you know, I would go and visit these friends, you know, they were just well off. They had a different way they were living. And the one thing that was, what I noticed was the same, was that their parents all went to school, went to these kind of organizations, did these kind of internships. So my entire focus, definitely in high school, was to get as many internships as I could get the best grades I can get, because I didn't come from that. You know what I'm saying? You know, my sister and I are first generation college and stuff. And so not only did I know that I didn't have any kind of path I was following, you know, and that may or may not help or hurt, but I said I needed to go beyond what they're doing. And so they're applying to the Howards, the Hamptons, the Morehouse, all of this stuff. I'm looking at my grades and I'm asking a guidance counselor, yo, what's the top five schools in the country? What's the top five? That's what I'm applying to. When I told my friends that, I got a big speech about being black, which, you know, I grew up black and poor, so I didn't really respond. My ears weren't hearing that. And I kind of felt, definitely when I went to middle school in Tanglewood, you know, in that gifted program from sixth grade to eighth grade, that was the first time I was really around like white folks on a regular. You feel me?
Mm-hmm.
So when I went there with some rich kids, not middle class, some rich kids, and start to go to their birthday parties and go to stuff, and you really start to see how poor you are. Like, oh, shit. And I'm doing the math, and then I'm going hanging out with them, and I'm just like, where'd your dad go to school? Josh, my dad went to Columbia. Hey, Allison, where'd your mom go to school? She went to Brown. Oh, I'm starting to do the math in my head. I go back to South Park, you know, and I realize that how do you get in there? You know, grades. And I had the grades. And so that made it very clear that that's the direction I'm going to head. Some of my friends was tripping a little bit. And then I told them, I need to see something different. I've been seeing black folks forever. You know, I really thought like that when I was that age, like, I got to see something different, man. I got to, you know. Lord, what I find out.
Marcus, which colleges did you consider?
Where did I get into?
Yeah, or just like what was in your top list?
What I got into. Let's just go there. I got into Harvard. I got into Howard.
Wow.
I got into Yale. I got into Morehouse. I got into Penn. I got into Fisk. You see what I'm saying? I wanted to go to Howard. I'll talk about it publicly now. I don't care. I wanted to go to Howard. I wanted to go to Howard because a lot of people I respected went to Howard. My best friend went to Howard. And I remember they didn't give me enough money, and I called the dean. I got him on the phone. I need like $2,000. He wouldn't give it to me. So I went somewhere else. I didn't pay to go to UPenn. I just leave that right there.
Was that a primary driver for you, the scholarship?
It was, I got a Pell Grant and some scholarships and realized I didn't have to take out a student loan for it. And then what it told me was, and my dad, in his infinite wisdom, bless his heart, he always had a very practical way of looking at things. And he said, well, what this school want to give you to go there? And I told him, he said, what about this other school you talking about in D.C.? I said, they don't want to give me how much more? You know, I said, like $2,000. And he asked how much it cost to go there, and I told him. He asked how much it cost to go to Penn, and I told him. And he said, and they going to let you go there for free? He said, yeah. He said, well, I think you already know what you got to do. And he said, you got to invest in those that's going to invest in you.
Hmm.
And so that's why it's always been funny to me is, you know, I love to hear the speeches at a HBCU. It's cute to me, but it got down to the wire and I talked to the dean. It was just two racks. I could have been one of your alumni, but I guess I wasn't worth $2,000. And that's how I look at it. And it's, the funny thing is, it ain't even, it's so cut and dry for me. And I've been thinking like that for a long time. It helps me make decisions. And later on, we'll talk about the big thing in how you make decisions. Because once you have certain ideas about who you are and what you want, it makes every decision you got to do super easy. And you don't have to beat yourself up about it.
Drew mentioned earlier that you got a BA in philosophy. How did you settle on that major?
Because Econ 3 and Calculus 3 was killing me when I was a finance major. Real talk. It just was hard. I started off as a finance major in the Wharton School in undergrad. I had done En-ROADS internship program working for what was then NCNB, then Nations Bank. And my whole thing was I was going to be a banker in finance. That was my whole thing, right? And man, you know, I was taking Japanese, Econ 3, Calculus 3, my freshman year, and it was just killing me, man. And then I saw what the product was. The Wharton people were jerks. And I was like, yo. I looked at my schedule. I was taking a survey course on Plato or something. And it's like, oh, shit, I can do this. You know, I turned some papers in. I changed my major. My mom was like, what? My dad was like, as long as you're still in school, you know. And I was the only Black person in the philosophy department at UPenn, except for two secretaries. And it would stay that way for a while. The effect was, by the time I got to law school, there was so much confidence and familiarity with them people that I had that I didn't feel intellectually inferior to anything. You know, I studied some hard stuff. I'd excelled in it. And I'd worked side by side with them in the world of arguments and things like that. So, and there's a reason I mentioned that, because when I went to law school, I went to school with friends who went to Black schools. There was a difference in the classroom, and we can get to that when we talk about law school. It's interesting. It's a social thing.
It sounds like you always had the bigger picture at the forefront, and you were always one step ahead, just listening to your story. And you mentioned that you graduated with a degree in philosophy. But after your undergrad, you actually became a financial analyst.
Let me correct that. My junior and senior year at Penn, I was a financial analyst.
Okay.
Oh, right. Okay.
At Hamilton Lane Advisors in Philadelphia, which is huge now. And I went directly into law school. So, God, what's his name? Tolbert. He's a Black banker in Houston who was one of my mentors. I had about three or four mentors through En-ROADS and friends in banking. Reddick Edwards, the late Reddick Edwards, was one. Gerald Smith, the bond guy, investment banker. Carlton Tolbert, who was at Nations Bank Real Estate Investment, and I'm missing somebody. These men would put me on to people. So Tolbert hooked me up with a gentleman named Les Brun, patient American guy who did private equity consulting for retirement funds. And he, the first 2 years at Penn, we stayed friendly and I was still doing En-ROADS. Then I left and he offered me a job. And I was as part time, I worked there for 2 years while I was getting a degree in philosophy. By the time I graduated, I had offers from iBanks, DLJ, Solomon, Goldman, Merrill, not because of my degree, but because of the experience I was getting as an analyst already, which was really weird because I had left the Wharton School. Important note. Normally, with Penn, and even if you're a finance major, whatever, you go out, do 2 years as an analyst, then you go to B school afterwards, and then from there, you become a managing director or something. That was the normal way you did your thing. I wasn't comfortable being in the marketplace with a philosophy degree. And, the only thing what I could see was either you teach philosophy, start a cult, or go to law school. And so I told my boss, I'm not comfortable, you know, it's a great job and thank you, but I feel super exposed with a degree in philosophy. You know, what does that do, right? You're in the business of ideas. And so I decided to go right into law school, which is what I did. And I came back south and went to Tulane Law School.
Marcus, so let's connect to our student listeners with some important lessons in that experience. First, working while in college, which it sounds like you did maybe a little bit part-time, full-time, but many students now need to understand the importance of internships.
Yeah.
And then your lesson about networking and, you know, connecting with people who are going to not only mentor you, but sponsor you. So talk about some of those lessons.
For high school students is this: if you are interested in something, find people who do it. Try to get a sit down with them. That's what I did. I was proactive with this. I created, you know, like I said, man, I have a ridiculous Rolodex now, if that's still a term. It's probably a term more than a thing now. But I built it. I built it from scratch. And the different programs and stuff that you get involved with, you meet different people. Try to be pleasant and inquisitive and curious. Ask questions. If it's a group setting, wait till after. If you didn't get a chance, email them, you know. And, hey, this is something I'm curious about. What was your day like when you work? What kind of schooling you had? What type of preparation you needed to do this job? What's considered excellence in your field? And I was like 17 asking these questions from these guys. And they were interested, like, man, he's like a journalist almost. No, I was trying to create a new point of context and reference for myself as I'm figuring out who I'm going to be. And I was meticulous about it. I was very strategic about it. And that enthusiasm translated into people's helpfulness. Oftentimes, I'll talk to young people. I did it recently with a friend of mine's daughter who just graduated from NYU, and she wants to be an entertainment lawyer. And we talked about that a little bit. And what I really talked to her about was her approach and her attitude. And like, the way you're moving right now, you're going to either not get there or slow yourself down. And so I had been fortunate to be exposed to some very successful Black men who shared a lot of information with me, and not just on what they were doing, but what they did in preparation to get there, you know, and at when they were my age. And that's another thing for the students listening. When you do get those interviews or meetups with those people, ask them, what were you doing at my age? It's not that you have to mimic. People have their different stories, but the successful folks, you know, you start tracking what they did. And then in the process, I started to see some things that was similar with all of them. And it had everything to do with work ethic. It had everything to do with work ethic.
Yes, sir.
And what's your work ethic, Marcus?
I mean, you know, it's known now. I got a Spartan work ethic. It's hardcore.
It's hardcore.
And, you know, it's been paying off for a long time. Find out what you want, find out how to get it, and don't skip the small steps, and don't take any excuses for yourself. Don't cheat. Don't take any shortcuts. Do it the long, hard way, and do the research and be informed about it, you know, and speak once you know. Don't speak too soon. You know, don't tweet too soon. If you want to go on and on about reparations, understand both sides of the argument. If you want to talk about, you know, anything, know what you're talking about before you open your mouth, because the people who are listening will clock, either this guy's an idiot or, they kind of know some things. It's the latter that people pay attention to, and it's the latter that people will be helpful towards. And I've experienced that for a long time in terms of people being willing to provide advice and guidance, you know, in certain areas.
Yeah.
So we asked for a deeper dive on undergrad, and would love to hear about your law school experience. But Drew, did I just cut you off? Were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say you're just dropping some nuggets on us, Marcus. But, you know, not skipping the small steps. Those are the life lessons that we try to, you know, we talk on 21 about, is that you can't skip the struggle. On that road to success, it's a windy road. It's not direct. It's not quick. And, you know, especially in this day of age, I like to look at it as the microwave era, where everyone wants everything quick and fast. And social media has a big influence on that. And you talk about that work ethic, and I think that's something that's going to always stand tall.
So the student athletes out there, once you get finished with school, life is, every day is two a days. And that's how you got to look at it. When you finish school and you're out working, every day is finals. Every day. You got to treat it like that until you get used to it, you know? And that's the approach, man. There are no light days.
That was undergrad. That was Penn. And then you came back down south for law school. Talk to us about that.
That was way out, because like, that's when the music stuff started really popping. I had been playing instruments and stuff for a while. And then, oh, this is crazy. I get to New Orleans and a friend of mine knows I play percussion and stuff. Said, man, you got to check out this guy named Bill Summers. I'm like, you know, who's that? And I'd look into him like, oh, snaps, the guy played with Herbie Hancock and all these different folks, you know, Grammy winning jazz musician, percussionist and stuff. Super cool dude. And just so happens his crib and his studio were right up the street from the law school. And we hit it off like magically immediately. He would end up really teaching me how to be a professional musician, not only in terms of performance, but recording, because we recorded a lot with different people. And that was one of my side hustles, man. Like I'd make my money, you know, doing that, go play a gig, you know, go do a recording session. I was broke, you know, I took out some loans for law school. And the process of doing that and doing session work, you'd be in there with other musicians. And yeah, man, like, I never forget, it all started very fast. Some musician in there looking at me, we, you know, in between sessions, see, bro, you in that law school? You know, he asked me and I said, yeah, man, can you look at this contract for me? And that's how it started. I had no idea what type of law I was going to do. You know, I just knew I didn't want to be out in the marketplace with a philosophy degree. And by my second year, I had done a record deal. I had to hire a lawyer so it would be on the up and up. At the time, No Limit Records was real big. So I did a joint venture between a No Limit record artist and Penalty Tommy Boy in New York. And I was a 2L. And so by the time I got back, it's like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to help fellow artists out. And that led me into the trajectory of being an entertainment lawyer.
But you actually started a band while you were there. Talk to us about that.
You end up playing. I was a working musician out there. You don't make a lot, so you play with different things. So a lot of students and cats that played with Bill, we formed a band. We were learning all this Afro-Cuban folkloric music. And we would put straight ahead jazz into it. And man, it just blew up. My last performance with that band before I left to go to LA was the Jazz Fest. You know, that was my last gig there. And I had, by the time I left New Orleans, I had played every major thing you could do in New Orleans. You know, the House of Blues, Tipitina's, you know, all the stuff on Frenchman Street, Jazz Fest, play stuff during Mardi Gras, you know, just regular, you know, doing that while studying and still in law school. And my professors would come to my gigs, you know, that was fun. You know, students would come out and I had a fun time. I was a fun dude in New Orleans, you know, and I was teaching eighth grade. Yeah, I needed money, man.
Well, we talked about it on the top of the show, the man of many talents. So what did you do immediately after law school? Just talk us through that journey.
I drove to L.A., literally.
Just on a whim.
No. I had set up, you know, so here's the thing. Like, my grades were okay, but I was working all through school. They could have been better. So I didn't get a chance to get all the great clerkships and all of this stuff, you know. I'm going to tell you, just let me tell you, I want the audience to listen to this. I'm in my second year going into my third year in law school. It's summertime in New Orleans. My grades are okay. I don't have no money. I don't have no clerkship. I am patching up roads with asphalt. You know what I'm saying? In the streets of New Orleans. I'm about to go to my third year of law school at a prestigious law school. Watching my classmates in the morning drive by in their suits to go to their internships and their clerkships. And they see me and I see them. You feel me? I'm getting off at 3 o'clock, lungs beat up from asphalt smoke, tired, back hurt, all that shit. But it didn't slow me down and it didn't make me feel any kind of way. You know, it's just what it was. You know what I'm saying? The board of trustees at the law school found out I had been teaching school, found out I had been laying asphalt. And they decided to give me some money my last year so I wouldn't have to do all those extra jobs to get, you know, lights and food and stuff. And so, you know, when I got out, I went through, you know, but still doing your work, you know, you're tired and all of that stuff. You know what I mean? I don't really remember sleeping in those days. But I got in the cars and I was interviewed. So what happened was I didn't have the summer internship at Paramount or this record label or whatever. And so they had an externship at the Directors Guild, which is a union for directors, that recent law grads could go there, work for 3 months, you know, and the idea is you go and interview for another job, whatever, whatever. So I didn't have no job offers, you know. It was the exact opposite of when I got out of undergrad. And I had sent a resume out there, and I remember I had gotten a call from the Directors Guild, said, you know, the guy wants to meet with your general counsel. I ain't no money. And my mom went in her savings and got me a plane ticket. And I flew out there, you know, and I got the job. And so I went to L.A. with a job, and in those 3 months, you got to go and try to lock your gig in. And that's what I did. Ultimately ended up at an entertainment law firm. One of few people that actually went directly from law school into entertainment law at the level, like for real entertainment law. That's the only kind of law I've ever practiced. It wasn't like we did personal injury too. I don't even know what a courthouse is in LA. It was like that. And so that's what happened. You know, it's like these little moments where people check for you or whatever. So it was crazy. It's going to LA. Like, man, I had to get that job. My mom went up savings to get that plane ticket. You know what I'm saying? And so it worked. Sat down with the guy, the general counsel. It's a union. I told him my dad was a longshoreman. So I grew up around that kind of energy, that kind of thing. And yeah, he offered me the gig, you know, and I started as a legal extern at the DGA. That was my first gig.
I love your story. I mean, for our listeners out there, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. And you talked about how you were out there on the roads. And it kind of reminded me when I was in high school and I was playing on the varsity basketball team, but I was working at McDonald's as well. McDonald's was my first job. And I remember one time the football team had came in there while I was on shift, and I was actually outside. My manager had told me to go pick the gum out the parking lot. And I remember the guys coming in there, you know, pooing high, making fun of me, like, what you doing out here, man? And I was just like, I looked at him and I was like, working, you know what I mean? Like, because I play varsity basketball, it don't mean that I'm rich. Like, I didn't have any money. So I had to just do what I had to do, similar to your story. But, you know, flipping back to your story, you back in LA, you practicing law for a period. So what happened? You pivoted after a couple of years, right?
No, I mean, I did that for a while. I did like 4 or 5 years, film, TV, and music. I made a lot of money really fast. I made a good name for myself. I carried it a certain way. It looked good on me. You know, the whole thing just popped. And, you know, I was starting to clock a change in myself and, you know, as a young man watching myself evolve into something. I wasn't totally stoked on the person that I was becoming. That was one thing. Two, the music industry was on a decline. So the money wasn't in certain areas where I just had that for sure money popping. That started to change. You know, this was the beginning of the end of like Tower Records and all of that. It was a big change that happens in the entertainment industry, but definitely the music industry because of Napster. And so, man, you know, by that time, it's about 4 years in, I had done everything imaginable, every sexy thing you could think of, man, that the just extra stuff that entertainment lawyers would do. You had the big clients and stuff. And the bigger the clients got, the more they started to feel like the people I was trying to protect them from. And then it brings me all the way back to the moment where you got an illiterate musician asking you to read their contract and then realizing they're about to sign something and get screwed over. And that was the reason I decided to be an entertainment lawyer. And what I always tell myself is anytime that line's blurred, then I got to stop and do something else because that was the whole point. And so I was getting in that space. The managing partner, I talked to him about it. He was super cool. And he was like, man, you not married, don't have any kids. You know, always go hang a shingle up and go do it. So I left. And that's just when he thought he got interesting, it got way more interesting. And it turned into a lot of different things. And it freed me up to explore things that I was interested in, things that I had done on the side, I'd start doing full time. And by accident, I became a writer. It wasn't planned. I never took a class in it, nothing. It just happened. And I found out I had a gift I didn't know I had.
I want to talk to you about that. But before we take a deep dive in your writing, did you change when you started making money, you know, after having been through, you know, some of the periods of struggle? Was that different for you and was that hard for you?
Well, one of the things that was interesting was I got power really fast and social acceptance really fast as an entertainment lawyer in a new city. And people knew that's who you were and that's what you did. And those who your clients are. And I'm like 24, 25, you know, stepping into a party, the red carpet, whatever. I leaned into that in that I enjoyed that light and what came with it. But I was very aware that I have to be cool because I didn't want to screw up the bag. And so lawyers rock a certain kind of way in Hollywood. We're not agents. Agents got different energy. Managers, different energy. Lawyers is some cooler energy. And so what I realized was, one, it didn't take long for the word to get out and for people to know who I am when I hit the door. And I'd go work the room or whatever. And then you're clocking what people are doing and trying to either get to you to get to your Rolodex, you know, and your client list. There's that part. There's people who want to do business with you just because, man, I heard he's a cool lawyer, man. Like that, he's a musician and shit. And there's that part, you know, there's the way that I handled myself socially that was interesting. It was always a gorgeous women with me all the time. And my crew was pretty cool and very smart. And well, I kept myself around some pretty successful Black people, both men and women. I had my homegirls too. You know, it wasn't just me bro-ing it up. You know, I had one homegirl. She's a big agent now. You know, another one's a lawyer. Now, we had a little unit and we would go and do things in groups. And so it kind of became like, yo, that's the, you want to kick it with them over there. They doing it big. They having fun. And I was young, you know, so it was cool to be able to go and buy stuff I was never able to buy and not check my bank account, you know, go have great lavish dinners and stuff like that, you know, and not, you know, it was up for, you know, working class kid. That was new for me. I think I handled it well. I was under pressure that I wasn't aware of, but also worked really hard. I give an example. The first year, every Saturday, I would go to the office, it's closed. And I would go through the files and I would take a client's file, right? And I would follow a deal from initial letter, heads of agreement or interest all the way down to the closing document. And then on Mondays, I'd ask whatever lawyer did it about that deal they did, because it wasn't a huge firm. They didn't have time to teach me a lot, but I took it upon myself to learn. They paid attention to that. I did that. I go order a pizza and sit in the thing, going through the files, reading how you did this big multi-million-dollar deal. I took it upon myself to become informed in the process, empowering myself rather than waiting for somebody to teach me anything, you know. And I don't wait on anybody to teach me anything. And look, I didn't grow up with YouTube and all that, you know. Like, there's really no excuse to be ignorant nowadays. You got Wikipedia in your pocket. But that was kind of like, you know, that was the MO for me. And whether I change, you're supposed to. You're not supposed to stay the same person. You know, like I remember somebody said one time, man, you know, you didn't change. You can say, you think I didn't work this hard to stay the same? You know what I mean? Of course you change. Absolutely you do. Changing to what is what it boils down to. Because usually when people say you didn't change, there's inference that it's something negative or displeasing. But I like the person I am now. I like the balance in my life. I like how I approach problems, how I deal with personal stuff, how I deal with them people, how I deal with our people, and how I deal with my child. I mean, I like where I'm at. You know what I mean? I think I'm the best version of me I've been so far. There's room for improvement.
And you'll always get better. But during this season, Marcus, you changed, or your writer came to the surface. Yeah. And you started writing. Can you see over my shoulder?
Yeah, I see the book. Appreciate that.
Yeah, it's a great book. So talk to us about your journey through writing.
Writing came out of nowhere because, like, I was running development for Rough Riders Film and TV Company. I was a client. So my boss said, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't leave law to go be a writer. I just need to go do something else. And he suggested go work for a client that needs you and can afford you. And so Rough Riders, we had some things in development. You know, there's like stuff going on and I was their guy out here. I said, why not just be your guy out here? And so that's what happened. So they sent me these boxes of scripts that was getting submitted. I had to read all of them and figure out what we're going to pick up to develop. And I say, it was all, most of it was trash. And I say probably about four or five scripts in on April Fool's Day, I had this weird idea like, man, I could do this. And so I went to the writer's store, I bought some software and a format book, and I started and haven't stopped. And I found out that I had it, like I said, I could tell a story, I could write it, I could see it, it worked. It's like, man, I didn't know I could do this. I read a lot. Let me back up a little bit. I'm a reader. And so that's really the school I had was reading. And I just kept going from there, man. And I ended up, it's like an addiction. And I leaned into it really hard. I found a different kind of awareness with myself and a different kind of gratification that went beyond money or any kind of social acceptance. And it was like really getting into your head and watching you figure out things in a way. It's hard to explain. And I kind of just forgot about everything and kept going until I was like homeless and living in a park.
Were you an avid reader as a child?
Reasonably. Not crazy reader, but I'd read, you know, I was a good student. I read my stuff. And I used to read Stephen King in middle school. I remember that was like one of my sister always had me reading the black stuff. So I read all the black stuff early. You know, you go to college, but then you go to white schools. You get these black kids having their first kind of like black awareness. All that stuff they were talking about, I read middle school. You know, I was already hip on that. But yeah, it's just that's just what happened. And it gets dark again. I've hit some dark valleys before, man, like a few times, or things where it looks like there's no answer. And I will say this, is that when you're at the bottom, it's dope. Because when you look up, you can see all these different kind of ways to get to the top. It's harder to see that when you're at the top and you're looking down and figure out how you got up there. And so some folks I've run across, they get into this whole thing where like, they're so fixated on this exact set of circumstances that have them in a bind and can't really look past it. So they just kind of, oh, boo, you know. And man, you know, sometimes you got to look around it. And I have a reputation for that. I'll move around something. Oh, this person's a problem. Let's tinker a little bit. Let's figure it out. What I'm not going to do is spend a lot of energy pointing at the obstacle and pontificating about it, because that does not move the needle at all. And there's examples in life at a personal to a professional level, to a career level, you know, where you can figure out how to get beyond something. So for the students, the big thing with school and multiple things, as you heard Drew say and myself, I worked all through high school as well. I worked at TJ Maxx and Astroworld and all kinds of places and stuff. It's time. Do your homework and assignments early. The minute you get it, you do it. And so let's say I was in second period high school. We get an assignment for such and such. Go to lunch. I'm working on that homework at lunch. By the time the school, we finish sixth period, most of my homework's done already. Why? Because I had to go to work from 5 to 11 o'clock at night, folding tiles at TJ Maxx. And so I look over what I did when I get home. This is when I start drinking coffee. And man, that little thing of doing the homework early gave you time to review it and make sure it was right. And it created a habit with me of getting stuff knocked out.
You took us back to Astroworld. When'd you work at Astroworld?
Got some flashbacks there.
Texas Highway Magazine just published an essay I wrote about that last month. I got to send it to you guys. I wrote, I was 15. I lied about my age. I worked in food services. I was a manager of a little ice shop in the little Alpine Village area right across from the Popeyes.
Yeah. That's great, Marcus. So you became a writer. You Well, you were always a writer. It just came out in you during this season of your life. And then you wrote Read Now Laters, which was released to a lot of critical acclaim. How did this book came to be?
I was writing short stories about kids that I grew up with just to keep my chops up in between the early days of my writing career. I was primarily doing feature films. I wasn't working in TV yet. And I was just starting to make a little money and kind of, you know, being able to really take care of myself. And I think I was writing about these kids I grew up with. I don't know if emotionally it was a bit of a lament for the city, because by that time I had lived in a lot of different places and I'd lost my accent for the most part. I'd kind of evolved as a person in a certain kind of way beyond my start, right? And enough time had passed to be reflective. I had achieved the things that I left home to be. Every step, the schooling, the job, I had left law. And so I had done all these things. And so I started writing about these kids. I was working on a memoir of a really famous filmmaker and non-active gang member here in L.A. Actually, the guy the guy that lived, that Suge rolled over. He directed this HBO documentary called Bastards of the Party, a guy named Bone Sloan. I had been interviewing him for his memoirs. It's a fantastic story. And Antoine Fuqua, the director, and Wood Harris from The Wire, the actor, had knew him and had told him, yo, you got to have this guy Guillory write your stuff. He knows that LA stuff, right? And so I connect with him, and he has this lit agent in New York who's real huge, and she'd been throwing all these big authors at him, and he's like, no, you got to let Guillory do this, blah, 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 blah. He's like, who's Guillory? And so I sent her a sample, a short story I had written, and a chapter of another book I was working on, and she hit him right back. She's like, I want to talk to him. And we got to talking, and she was really interested in my voice. And so I just started getting short stories published, some of these short stories that, you know, were about these kids. So I told her, I said, I had an idea to put out a book of short stories about these kids I grew up with. And she was like, yo, they're not really buying short story collections right now. They're all connected. She compared it to like this book, Perdido Street, which like these anecdotes that are all connected. She said, I got to turn it into a book. And I was like, what? I was like, click. I didn't see myself as a novelist. I wrote screenplays. I was writing short stories. I'd never written a book before, and I didn't know how to write a book. I knew how to write a screenplay. However, what I didn't do was tell myself that I couldn't write a book, but I thought about it for 6 months, which kind of tripped her out a little bit, ego-wise. I didn't just go run and do it because she said. I had to think about it. Is this something I could do? You know, that's long for me. I don't do the doubt thing at all. I'm very objective about what skill sets we have. Do we have time? What's the level of excellence that's expected? Can we meet that? Can you meet it for yourself? If you can't, leave it alone. You know, otherwise you're entertaining all kind of stuff. Took the short stories, used it as a framework and built around it. Short stories in total were probably about 60 pages. When the manuscript was finished, it was about 800 pages. Ended up getting a multi-book deal with Simon & Schuster. It came out. It's called Read Now Laters. And it was about growing up in South Park, for the most part. And I wanted to, nobody ever written about South Park, right? Ever. Only time I ever seen my neighborhoods in print was on a crime report in a newspaper, or some athlete went there. And so I knew the charge, everybody at the, you know, this is before everybody was super waxing poetic on Third Ward. That's a whole nother conversation. But I wanted to give my neighborhood and my city a certain kind of beauty that's kind of hard to find in a place that's flat and below sea level and very humid. The color palette of Houston is like grays and browns. It's not very vibrant in terms of colors popping that you might see in other places, like in terms of like seeing seasons change. And so it was important to find the beauty in the people and the language of the people our expectations of ourselves, and how sometimes that can be a beautiful thing. And once I realized that and started looking at the way the relationships work for this kid, as you watch him get, you know, come to age, that it would be interdependent on his family and who he's connected to, and that the ideas were all an amalgamation of a lot of different people's experiences, your ancestors, what they went through, what their anguish was, what their joy was. All of that stuff writes the fabric and creates the fabric of who you are. And so I think, you know, it was the proper first book to put out for literary fiction. It was a bit of a veiled biography with a couple little twists to it. But had I known now, I might have put out something different just for commercial reasons. The next book is completely different and way out there. But I think, and at the end of the day, I think it was a love letter to the city. I felt about it. I don't know anybody's wax poetic about Houston the way I did in that book, not even a rapper. And Scarface even agrees with that.
Read Now and Laters. Where can our listeners pick it up, Marcus?
Where can you buy it? I didn't do an audio, but anywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, it's out there in the world.
Well, thanks for taking us down that journey, Marcus. We really thank you for your time today. Your story has been amazingly intriguing and inspiring at the same time. So we appreciate your time today, my man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Marcus, it was a blessing to grow up with you. It's an honor to call you friend, and just thank you for being you.
I appreciate it.
Writer and producer, Marcus J. Guillory.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in. To the athletes, keep being the best you can be. Run your race with excellence. To the parents of athletes, let's continue to support our children with patience, grace, and understanding, learning to recognize how to truly become the guides and the stewards that we are supposed to be. To everyone, be willing to share your experiences to help others along their paths, and always be open to the wisdom that comes your way.
For more information about the 21 Podcast, 21 Media, and services provided by Train Harder 21, visit the website at drewlasker.com and follow us across all social media platforms. Remember to add this podcast to your playlist, subscribe, rate, and review. Until next episode of 21, Train Harder.